My name is Sharon, and I serve the village as educational coordinator, and it's my privilege to welcome back Vermont Brown. And first, we need to thank him for that service last night. That was fabulous. Thank you so much. And tonight's talk is Racism 2.0. Thank you, Vermont.
All right. Well, it was nice to give the village some blues last night. So I'm talking about racism today, of course. And so we'll get started, and I'll just go down my list here. Not all of this makes sense to you, but it makes sense to me. So it will jog my memory about stuff. So what I want, these are two different sheets of paper, but they're the same thing. So you take one and pass it around. If we run out. I didn't want to copy too much because I don't know where Olin stands on paper these days. So just take one. And my stuff comes out of this one book called White Rage, by Carol Anderson. It may be in the bookstore. I put it on the list. It may be in the bookstore. Thank you. And this one is White Fragility. How many of you have seen this one? This has been around a lot. She's all over the web. And so, anyway, it originates from these books here. So, and so, is the paper all the way around?
Nope.
So I would like for you to read what's on the paper, to find one thing that sticks out for you, and let us know if you find it apropos or it's goofy, or if it's just goofy.
Could someone read it out loud? Because we don't have it up here.
I think she's making more copies, so.
Oh, okay.
Or would someone like to read them out loud? How about the one that has the front and the back? Would somebody read that out loud? Is somebody willing to do that?
Sure.
All right.
This list is based on Peggy McIntosh's article on white privilege. These dynamics are but a few examples of the privilege which white people classes have. On a daily basis, as a white person, one, I can, if I wish, arrange to be in the company of people of my race most of the time. Two, if I should need to move, I can be pretty sure renting or purchasing housing is an area which I can afford and in which I want to live. Three, I can be pretty sure that my neighbors in such a location will be neutral or pleasant to me. Four, I can go shopping alone most of the time, pretty well assured that I will not be followed or harassed. Five, I can turn on the TV or open to the front page of the paper and see people of my race widely represented. Six, when I am told about our national heritage or about civilization, I am shown that people of my color made it what it is. Seven, I can be sure that my children will be given curricular materials that testify to the existence of their race. Eight, if I want to, I can be pretty sure of finding a publisher for this piece on white privilege. Nine, I can go into a music shop and count on finding the music of my race represented, into a supermarket and find the staple foods which fit with my cultural traditions, into a hairdresser's shop and find someone who can cut my hair. 10. Whether I use checks, credit cards, or cash, I can count on my skin color not to work against the appearance of financial reliability. 11. I can arrange to protect my children most of the time from people who might not like them. 12. I can swear or dress in a secondhand clothes or not answer letters without having people attribute these choices to the bad morals, the poverty, or the illiteracy of my race. 13. I can speak in public to a powerful male group without putting my race on trial. 14. I can do well in a challenging situation without being called a credit to my race. 15. I am never asked to speak for all the people of my racial group. 16. I can remain oblivious of the language and customs of persons of color who constitute the world's majority without feeling in my culture any penalty for such oblivion. 17. I can criticize our government and talk about how much I fear its policies and behavior without being seen as a cultural outsider. 18, I can be pretty sure that if I ask to talk to the person in charge, I will be facing a person of my race. 19, if a traffic cop pulls me over, I can be sure I haven't been singled out because of my race. 20, I can easily buy posters, postcards, picture books, greeting cards, dolls, toys, and children's magazines featuring people of my race. 21, I can go home from most meetings of organizations I belong to feeling somewhat tied in rather than isolated, out of place, outnumbered, unheard, held at a distance, or feared. 22, I can take a job with an affirmative action employer without having coworkers on the job suspect that I got it because of race. 23, I can choose public accommodation without fearing that people of my race cannot get in or will be mistreated in the places I have chosen. 24, I can be sure that if I need legal or medical help, my race will not work against me. 25, if my day, week, or year is going badly, I need not ask of each negative episode or situation whether it has racial overtones. And 26, I can choose blemish cover or bandages in flesh color and have them more or less match my skin.
All right. Does anyone have any issue with this? So that's where we start. We start with white privilege. There's a woman here, Robin DiAngelo, who wrote the book that most of you have seen before, White Fragility, where she talks about white people being uncomfortable when you talk about race. And the first thing they want to say is that I'm not a racist. And they give reasons. I'm not a racist because my granddaughter is black. I'm not a racist because I have a black friend. I'm not a racist because I went to a black high school. And so they started giving excuses for why they're not racist. Others just get angry, or they want to change the subject. Some people cry to get you off the subject, which she calls white tears, to get you off the subject. And so this is what she says, and she says that racism is not an individual thing. It's systemic. It's baked into this culture, into the society, and that U.S. institutions, our institutions, is what keeps us, you know, helps us keep people out. Who can name some institutions? I think there's about maybe 12 or 15, but who can think of some?
The law.
The law, legal?
School.
Education?
Tax code.
Tax code?
Prison.
Prison?
Housing.
Housing?
Churches.
Churches?
Public safety.
Public safety?
Healthcare.
Healthcare?
Banking.
Banking, of course.
Voting.
Church?
Voting.
Voting. All of those. Prison, you can just change to the legal system, because we're well represented in prison. So those are our institutions, and so what I want to do now is, does everybody have, I didn't pass them. Just take a piece of paper. In fact, you can rip them in half and pass them along. Here's some more, too. More paper where?
Up above.
Up above? Nine, okay. Let me know when you get some up there. So, I'm basing this talk mainly on black people. For obvious reasons, number one, I'm black. Number two, other, you know, you can fit other people in this, but I can talk more securely about black people. I'd be making assumptions about women, Native Americans, Hispanics. You know, I just don't know that as well. But this is focused on black people, and we have a long history of that, so we can start there. So this is what I want you to do with your paper. I want you to ball it up, and from where you sit, don't move, from where you sit, try to make it in that trash can. All right. How many of you made it? Who made it? Did someone make it from far away? Who made it from far away?
No,
nobody?
I missed.
Okay. So what does that, feel like?
Disadvantage. I was lucky to sit where I sat.
So, say that again.
Tough odds.
Okay.
I feel discriminated against in the back corner.
you're just not good enough. These people were good who made it in there. It's not good enough. So this is what white privilege is like. You notice the people in the front weren't complaining too much. I saw someone just dunk it in there. And white privilege is like that in the sense that there's a people in front who are in the know, who get in our universities and various institutions. First person comes to mind is that Felicity Huffman, do you all remember?
Yeah.
And how they cheated to get their kids in good colleges. That kind of thing goes on all the time. And on top of that, people of color, black people in particular, are blocked out of those institutions. They're invited, but they're blocked out. I went to a seminary, and I was one of, when I was in college, I was like one of four black people. When I was in seminary, I was maybe one of five. And it was, you know, it was grueling. It was difficult because I didn't know the inside story. You know, I met people there whose parents had been, you know, whose fathers had been pastors. They knew professors. All of that kind of inside stuff. And so people are left out of these institutions because they don't have the inside stuff. And our country is loaded with that, and that's what this, all of this is about. Slavery lasted that long. There were people who just, that's all they ever knew of America was slavery. And then there was black codes, which was, who knows what black codes were? Black codes were when they were, it was after slavery, and people would ride around, and if they saw black people who they think looked unemployed or were doing a job that, you know, wasn't up to their standards, they put them back and made them work back on the farm in the fields. Then there was Reconstruction that came along after slavery, where slaves were beginning to be seen as people. They even had a couple of black congressmen. And then Andrew Jackson came along in 77 and put an end to all of that, got rid of the congressmen and put an end to all of that. And after 10 to 12 years of progress, we were thrown back, you know, into the dismal way that we were living. Does that sound familiar? Then KKK came, you know, a terrorist group, 1877, still exists today. Lynching went from 1865 to the 1950s. The latest one was in 1981, but that was just one single one. But still, the lynching went on. That's another way of keeping people out of institutions. If you want to talk about systemic racism, this is it. It's not an individual thing. It's what's the thing that prejudice plus power equals?
Racism.
So there wasn't individuals doing this. It was prejudiced people plus power, usually the Congress, passing these laws. So all of this was legal as far as the Constitution was concern. Sharecropping, another dismal way of life where you never get ahead, but you still work the land for almost free. Jim Crow, segregation, white, black, this, that, separate but equal kind of stuff. redlining still goes on today, started in 1934 with the National Housing Act. Who knows what redlining is? Who can? What is it, somebody?
Zoning, so that they're segregated. So, like a systemic.
All right, thanks. Prison industrial complex, which affects, after you get out of prison, it affects jobs, housing, any kind of monies you may be getting, be eligible for, like Social Security or any kind of welfare kind of stuff. And about a third of all African-American men have had some interaction with the judicial system and the prison or jail. I have a nephew right now who's doing 4 years for possession, and he's lost contact with his children. He had two kids, both five and under. One was five, one is under. And it's just poof, it's just gone. You know, if he wants to make contact with them when he gets out, he's got to look for them all again, but I don't know who, I don't know what kids that age remember, you know.
Possession of?
Of drugs. So. Yeah. Brown versus Board of Education. Schools were totally segregated until 1954, but that's not totally true because I went to a segregated school in the 60s. So, you know, with all of these laws, depending on what city or state you're in, they take their time enforcing them, you know. It was the same way with Juneteenth. Who knows what Juneteenth is? Tell us what Juneteenth is.
Celebration of the Emancipation Act, is it? No?
Emancipation of the slaves?
Right.
Yeah, but they were late, you know. I mean, slavery was 2 years late, you know. So, and that was in Texas. So Texas took its time with letting people know that. Social Security Act of 1934, 65% of black people weren't eligible for that because the South made sure that farmers and domestics weren't eligible for Social Security. So, and that's what most blacks were doing at that time. So we missed out on that. Let's see, with Voting Rights Act of 1965, white women got the vote in 1920, but all black women didn't get the vote until 1965. And then there's the GI Bill. Most black soldiers didn't see much from the GI Bill because to get a house, you have to get a loan from a bank. Banks wouldn't give black people loans. And so, and under all that led to underemployment. And so 15 million, and while that was going on, 15 million white people got 160 acres of free land for $18 fee. And so that was going on while the blacks were being taken from. Farmland was taken from black people in the South if they were trying to do their farm. They couldn't get credit, and they also had the sundown laws. Who knew what the sundown laws are?
Be home after dark.
Yeah, yeah. You couldn't be out after sundown if you were a black person. And how are you going to run your business if you can't do that, and if you can't get credit? 98% of all farmland belongs to white people, and only 1% belongs to black people. So the reality of all this means what?
Power is all in the hands of white people.
Okay, and what else does it mean?
Money.
Black folks are starting way behind the starting line.
Yeah. And what does that mean?
We can't get ahead.
But it also means that you, as white people, have never, ever had to compete with black people. We're always behind in education, in jobs, in experiences. You know, you've never had to compete with us. So you've had a whole lifetime and more, I mean centuries, of not having to compete with people of color. You can be for sure, if you're walking down the street, that this black person coming towards you makes less money than you, is less educated than you, has less experiences than you, you know? And so that is what racism is, not this individual thing of who likes who or who gets along with who. It doesn't really matter. You know, if a white person doesn't like me, what do I care? You know, but what I do care about is trying to make a living. And with this list, what else is going on here?
It's generational as well. It's hard to ever break a cycle when you have such rigid systems that hold people back.
That's true. But it also means that these people will, you'll never have to, what's the word I'm looking for? It means that you'll never have to compete with these people. I said that earlier. You don't have to compete with them at all. And, you know, you're better than, it always means that you're better than any black person you see. And I know you say, oh no, we're not better, but how can you not think that way when society is telling you that all the time, every day? You know, you eat better, you're better traveled, you're better educated, you know, everything is better. It's baked into the sauce that everything is better. You get the experiences, you know, we get this. And it's like, so how are you to, who are you to say that you're not better than black people? Yes.
In 1964, I was in the Marine Corps on Okinawa, and in the 2nd Battalion, I bunked in a squad bay with a bunch of people, and for the first time, I was next to a black guy. His name was Lamar Fort. His dad had been in the State Department, so he had traveled all over the world. And there were nights when we got in discussions, and one night, he said, "Craig, you're racist." And I said, "I am not." I was offended. I used to sing "Jesus Loves Little Children." I'm not prejudiced. And I was offended, but he insisted, so we let it go. And it took me nearly 10 years with his words ringing in my ears before I began to see what he was talking about. But if he hadn't said that, I don't know how long it would have taken me. That I am racist.
Well, I don't know if you yourself are racist, but you benefit from a racist society. You know, all of this you benefit from. All of this you make money from. And they take money from us. And the thing about it, about this list, is that what's going on here is that every man and some women in the prime of their lives, from 18 to 54, you know, is taken out of the picture. You know, so you never have to compete with anyone in those prime working years for jobs, for education, for experiences, because our society has made sure that white people are ahead of black people. And it continues, of course, to this day, this injustice that continues to work with us. There's a phrase called mad larius, and it's a combination of being mad at something, but it's so crazy, it's hilarious. I grew up in Kansas City, and there was a park called Swope Park, and the park years ago was segregated. So first of all, how do you segregate a park? I don't know. But the park was segregated, and they had a swimming pool, and the swimming pool was segregated, but then they said, okay, we gotta integrate the swimming pool. So what they did was that from Tuesday to Saturday, white people could swim in the pool. From Sunday to Monday, black people could swim in the pool. No, from Saturday to Sunday, black people could swim in the pool. And on Monday, they changed the water. Isn't that crazy? It's just silly. It doesn't make any sense.
No.
I remember going to see a movie in Palestine, Texas. And me and my cousins, we were all going, my brothers and my cousins and I, we were all going to a movie. So I remember the name of the movie. It was Annette Funicello movie. Didn't she make a movie called The Yellow Polka Dot Bikini?
How to Stuff a Wild Bikini.
Maybe that was it. Yeah, I know bikini.
Sorry.
But anyway, so my brothers and I, we start going into the movie, and our cousins froze and says, no, you can't do that. You can't do what? You can't go there. Where? You can't go and sit on the main floor. We have to sit up in the balcony. And even at 14 years old, it was like, you know, it just took the wind out of our sails. I mean, this is crazy. It doesn't make sense. And over the years, it just got funny. It was just so ridiculous. But, you know, a lot of this, the sundown laws are ridiculous. There are places you couldn't pay. Who saw the Green Book?
Yeah.
Yeah. That whole thing was crazy. We had a segregated cemetery in Kansas City. You know, so anyway, you know, that's part of the whole Matt Larry's thing. It's just hilarious. But what it is really power over. It's, you know, putting your power over people. And so, you know, that's kind of where we are, where we end up. Any questions or comments? Anybody ever run up against this? Or does this make sense to people? Do you know this? And what do you say when you see it? Does anybody speak out, or what are you doing to
vote?
Go ahead.
Vote.
Okay. But to be woke.
No, vote.
No, I know you said vote. But I'm saying to be woke. If you want to be woke, it's more than what you know or what you say, it's what you do. You know. And so as white people, you know, if you want to be woke, you gotta make a move. You can't just be there and continue to live off of the oppression of others. Redlining still exists, you know, to this day.
I think a lot of it is educating ourselves, and I mean, I thought the White Fragility was a particularly good book for that, in talking about how, you know, working really hard not to get defensive, working really hard to understand. She has a good analogy in the back about, you know, the first job is to go and learn. If you were, I think the story she tells is if you were diagnosed with a doctor with a disease you didn't know what it was, and you knew it was something serious, the first thing you do is go and do a bunch of research and really educate yourself. That's what needs to happen in terms of the first steps to try to really look at the systems. So a lot of it for me is talking to other people to make, you know, working with my coworkers. We've been doing a lot of this work just trying to educate ourselves as a first step. For a lot of people, this is still something they're not aware of, unfortunately, I think, to this level.
What else, what have people done to take the path of least resistance?
Ignore.
Go silent.
Yeah, time will take care of things.
So, you know, you can see why black people don't come to hold them. You know, because we've got this history. And nothing in this history tells us that things are better when some of this stuff is still going on. And this is national. My goodness, what's going on locally in places, in towns, and in major cities, you know. It just keeps adding on and piling on.
The comment, time will heal. I mean, there has been improvement, yet is not happening fast enough. What does it take to get there? Is it an individual effort? Is it getting the right voting? Is it getting the right members to move that forward? Have you seen improvement in your lifetime?
Well, I saw improvement with Barack Obama. And then what happened after that? You know, I mean, that's for nobody black was surprised about that, but it was just, it was a backlash, you know. And, you know, most of the people who voted for Bush, I mean, not for Bush, for Trump, they said, was white women. He got the highest number of votes from white women. So I don't get it. What's that saying? What is that saying about our country or where we are, or you know, are we taking anyone else into consideration?
I mean, that's the power of it, right? Is that the backlash is to do the fear tactic, to make people afraid of other people, to demonize, to mobilize everything. And then the privilege part is that you don't have to think about it, actually. You have choice. It's not in your face all the time. You have to be intentional to think about it when you're white. But you can go throughout your day and not have to think about it or do something about it. And I think that's what takes a lot of effort is how do you intentionally, consistently choose to be aware of your power and to use it the way it's supposed to be used, not for comfort.
One of the things that a lot of institutions do is to try to be deliberate about diversifying their leadership. And I'm wondering what the community here thinks about how does Holden Village be a deliberate and aggressive about diversifying, and that when we show up here, we see people of color and celebrate those differences and engage a community that's been disengaged, apparently, from the community for a long time.
I think before we push to bring in a person of color in the leadership into a place where we are probably not aware of all the unsafe feeling things that can happen in a normal day for a person of color in a community like this, we as white folks have to do the work first to make it be a place that will be safe for a person of color. I mean, for Lon to stand up in front of all us and do this is amazing, but it probably takes a lot bigger toll on you than it would on a white person saying exactly the same things. And so I think we can't say, well, let's bring in diversity and they'll teach us how we should be doing things. We have to do it first and not depend only on people of color tell us what we should be doing.
What are you afraid of as white people, or people of color, coming into the village? I'm kind of at a loss for that. What's the hesitation? What's the?
You mean coming in general or in leadership positions?
Well, in leadership positions, and in general too. I mean, you're lacking in general as well, so. Both. What's the hesitation?
Well, they don't know about the history of Holden.
Well, you didn't before you got here, did you? None of us did before we got here. But most of us didn't before we got here.
I think there's a fear that history won't be respected.
You got any proof of that?
No. But I think that fear is there. And I think that fear shows up in politics generally, too.
I fear that, like, Lutheranism and my faith is a faith that has been forced on to people in a way that I don't want to continue to force on to anyone, and that it has been something that missionaries try to create and implement in other communities as a way to put them down. And so, I mean, I personally don't know a whole lot of people of color who are Lutheran.
I do.
Cool.
There's actually a lot of people of color that are Lutherans. You know, black folks started Lutheran churches long ago, 300 years ago. The largest Lutheran population is in Tanzania. It's an African country. But we have this false idea that Lutherans are right.
ELCA is the whitest denomination in America.
There's a lot of discrimination in the church just among the white people. If you're not Norwegian or you're not. it's crazy. I mean, I'm not any of that. I'm not white, Catholic, Hispanic. And there's always jokes. They're always, you know, pro these people. That's what you hear in the church.
It's insider language all of the time, and it's pervasive, and it's exclusive.
When I first
Black Church, Lutheran Church in Norwegian Minneapolis.
When I first came to Holden, you know, I was of course the only black person here, and they kept telling these jokes, and I was like, now who is Sven? There's another one too. Who's the other one?
Lena.
Yeah, Lena. I'm like, who are these people? And different times they'd be different people would be the butt of the joke, and I said, well, which one is, you know, is sort of the goofball? Which one is?
All of them.
And they used to have nights where they'd sit around the fire here and tell Ole and Lena jokes. Yeah. And I'd sit back and I'd think, you know, I didn't get it. You know, they'd go into the accents and tell the jokes, and, you know. But I did it. And I came here in 76, I came here in 77, I came here in 83. I was a village pastor from 90 to 93. You know, so like, I did it. And so part of my feeling is, what's keeping you from doing it? I mean, people are stepping out. I have several black Lutheran pastor friends. You know, they did it. You know, we all stepped out, so what's to stop you? Are you that afraid of what you've created with this? I mean, is this? Do you ever think about this and think this is what's on their mind, or does it bother you that you never have to compete with these people toe to toe? Or is that a relief for you? Do you?
It seems overwhelming. Like, how do you start? How do you act other than be kind to each other and, you know, live out of love? But how do you dismantle that then? And when you come to sessions like this and hope you get ideas?
One thing you have to deal with is what you do with your inheritance. If some percentage of that is ill-gotten, is it legitimate to pass it on to your children who really don't need it? Or then you come up with some creative way of trying to right some injustice?
Did you hear about Georgetown? Who heard about Georgetown?
Yes.
Tell us about Georgetown.
There's a movement amongst the student body to
can't hear you.
There's a movement amongst the student body to ask for or charge a certain amount to tuition to make reparations for the income that Georgetown made off the sale of slaves in the 1700s, I think.
They've also admitted students who are descendants of those slaves. They've given them an opportunity to go to Georgetown.
I was talking to the priest who was running that whole program, the Acts of Reparation. He was talking about how it was very much a partnership with the descendants, and he wasn't saying, like, hey, you what do you think? I was saying, what do you think about this? But how can we best work together? Because we recognize, and just having to call out all the past injustices, even though it's so uncomfortable, especially such an established university. So I think first recognizing openly how you benefited from those injustices, and then kind of bringing in that conversation. Challenging, but good process.
There are colleges built on stolen land from black people in the South. And there are people who got land from their ancestors that were in that people who got 160 acres. And they're being paid not to grow certain crops on their land. So they're getting money from free land to not do anything on that land. I mean, that's another bad Larry's kind of thing to think about, you know. I mean, that's just crazy. You can make money from free land, you know.
Was financial reparations to the answer? That's a big topic now in Democratic caucuses. And I don't know, if you throw money at a problem, is that going to solve the problem?
The bills, but the bills for reparation don't talk about money. They're just talking about recognition. There's no talk in those bills about money.
No financial.
No financial. It's just talking about opening a discussion to explore, you know, what to be done. But there's nothing in there about money. Everybody thinks it's about money, but it's
yes.
not.
Yes.
Well, you know, that's sort of bullshit, really. We want money. You know, everything on this list is money taken away from people. You use it, you know, cotton was king back in the 16 and 1700s. And who was keeping that going? That was the backs of slaves. Working for nothing, you know, and now you're going to sit and squabble over money? Yes, money. And if we want to take that money and buy donuts with it, you know, we should be able to do it because it's our money, you know.
Well, the Native Americans could say the same thing, right?
Well, yeah, and they're right too.
Yeah.
I mean, that those 160 acres of land that the government gave people, they probably had to go out and kill Native Americans to get it. So, you know, the only one who thinks it's not about money are white people who have money.
Yeah, in South Africa, they did reconciliation after the apartheid, and that was not about money, but they are now talking about their land reform. It has to be solved for them to go any farther with where they are. So they can't just leave it without solving the land.
Bishop Tutu said this wonderful thing. He said that when the Dutch came to South Africa, they had the Bible, we had the land. Today, we got the Bible, they got the land. You know, so, you know, the people, the oppressors, they know what's important, you know, and it's land. You know, and everything on here makes sure that they keep the land.
Suggested all to try to identify black churches through the Lutheran organizations. It can certainly be identified where they are and have some idea where to start. There's churches that are Lutheran, that are black. Identifying them has to become a suggestion.
I think that's a good suggestion. And I also think it goes beyond Lutheranism, too.
Yeah.
The Methodist Church is way more black than us Lutherans. And how do we bring that fold into our conversation, too? It's not just about Lutheranism.
We'll give you a name, Redeemer Lutheran Church in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
A name of what?
Church,
a black Lutheran church in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
I know the pastor there. He's been here a number of times. Yeah, Redeemer, the pastor there. He's been here a number of times. He's brought people from his church here, too. But, yeah.
Did they come back?
No, but...
Did they
feel
welcome?
Huh?
Did they feel welcome?
Yeah, they felt welcome, but it's just not a priority of theirs right now. You know, they have other things to do in their community with their people and running away in the wilderness for them. It's important. It's a their priority.
We laugh, but...
It's true.
I mean, it's a real issue, and we can put the invitations out, but people, it's hard to get to hold them.
And it costs a lot of money.
It costs a lot of money, and you have to have the luxury of time. Mm-hmm. And so we even have a place that creates a community space that favors people of means.
A luxury.
Just to generate financial help for them. We've done it in our church for people that didn't have places where they could pay for gifts for help when they were young.
We had it for Opera Ed over the Hispanics. They took it for a week.
Flower kids.
Yeah, well, we did the scholarships and they're offered. Are the scholarships?
Yeah, they actually let me stay for free one time. I'm a rich white guy. My name is Carlos.
Do they provide scholarships here?
Yes.
They do. So, I don't know how much.
We just need a blues week.
I'm wondering, too, about, you know, it's becoming more recognized, at least in the Pacific Northwest, how underrepresented people of color are in outdoor recreation and wilderness activities. And there's a huge gap there of accessibility to people of color. And that's maybe another factor as to why wholeness is on the radar of other populations. And I'm wondering if the Holden model could be made more accessible by creating satellites that are closer to people in different parts of the country, or, you know, that would maybe be comfortable in different ways. I can't imagine that people would be welcome up here, but it's knowing about it and the accessibility and the finances and everything.
Well, if black people had the access to the resources that white people had who created Holden, we could create our own spaces where we'd want to go. I joke with my friends that I've never seen a black person walk through the village coming out of the mountains. And there's some truth to that, and there is some fear about being in the wilderness and running into, you know, white people who, you know, if you're black and you're in the wilderness and they're white, there's a certain amount of fear that goes on with that. But you know, we could create our own spaces where we go and we feel safe, and create something like Holden in our own fashion, you know. But it's a resource thing. It's not just you being generous, you being open. I mean, one of the things with my white friends that I talk about is that I spent a lot of time congratulating them, telling them how good it was that they got into college, or they got a scholarship, or they got a job. Meanwhile, my career is stalled, you know. And I think that's, you know, black people are tired of the generosity of white people, you know. We want to create our own generosity. And we could do that if this wasn't on our backs, you know. And so what has to happen is that this has to get off our backs, you know. The redlining, the KKK, the hostilities, the, you know, for that to happen, and we can invite you to our space and say, come to our space. I'm not sure how many of you could do what I do, go to a place that's all black by yourself and make a way in there. I mean, I'm not bragging or anything. I'm just saying, if the shoe were on the other foot, you could do that. And part of that is because you're simply not used to the generosity of people of color. Mm-hmm. You know?
That's true. My wife and I were invited to a party. It was many years ago, but a party given by black friends of ours. And we walked into the party, and we were the only two white people there. We knew many of the people, but it was just a weird, strangely strangely disorienting experience. You know, we felt no hostility, we were welcome, and yet it was just a strange experience. And I think that must be true for every black person who ever comes here.
I dropped here a little between,
who in here knows about reconciling in Christ? Right, what that is. So that's a process that churches go through to be welcoming of LGBTQ people, right? And say, we think they're great, we'd love them to be part of our community, we think it's okay if they're pastors, right? But they went through a process of understanding that, understanding the people, and how to be welcoming. Churches didn't say, hey, we're going to be great if we just add some gay people to our congregation, right? So when you go into a congregation that hasn't done that work, and you're a queer person walking in, there's a real high chance that they're going to do harm to you, right? So I don't know why in the Lutheran church we keep thinking, if we just add people of color, it's going to be all good. When in fact, a tremendous amount of harm happens within the Lutheran church all the time. The average call wait for a woman of color to be a Lutheran pastor, 5 years, because churches don't want to call her.
I want to go back to that welcome thing. For example, I'll probably be invited to preach at my daughter's church in the south side of Chicago in about a month when my granddaughter's baptized, and I've preached there before. It's a black congregation except for my daughter, and they've just been so wonderful to welcome me. And I say, well, why should I preach to you? What do I have to say? But the black woman pastor invites me when I'm there to preach. And I just really appreciate that welcome.
My husband and I my husband was the pastor of a church on the south side of Chicago where things got very real. The church was about 97% African American. It had been a Swedish church on the south side of Chicago. And in the 1960s, the pastor there, I mean early in the 60s, he did his best to integrate that church. And what happened was black people came and then white people left.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we had a number of community forums in that church where we invited the neighborhood and people from other churches in Chicago to come. And one of the questions was a good question that you asked tonight, sir, about, you know, what do you fear? What's going on between white and black people? And one of our parishioners got up and said to the group, you don't engage with us because you're afraid that you're going to have to deal with black rage. There was dead silence for about 3 minutes. I mean, that was a very real thing to say. And it was a very sobering experience. So, yes, He said, you don't engage with us because you're afraid of our rage, because we have been hurt by you.
I think that perspective of engagement is very significant. I believe in getting to know your neighbor. And just this week, how many different people have I chosen to engage, even though they're white folk? Engaging takes energy and courage and a sense of humor. Engagement with each other is the beginning step.
I think it's hard to, especially for black folks, to engage with a population that doesn't mostly understand what's on the whiteboard there. This seems like a fairly actualized group of most of a lot of weeks that we have. I know even I, until 4 years ago, probably only knew about 5 of those things. Like, I didn't know anything about the GI Bill. My dad, we had a house. My dad got an education. I have to be able to tell my story truthfully. And until we can all tell our stories more truthfully, it's really hard to engage with someone who does not have a clue about how things are actually operating.
I think that part of that is also, as white people who have been in places of power and opportunity, that we need to highlight the history that Vermont has on this board and talk to our neighbors about it and our friends and our kids and our grandkids and remind them that we as white people have had so much opportunity and so few barriers, and that their friends who have darker skin do not have the same freedom and potential that they have. And the more we talk about it with our own peers and call each other out when we are demonstrating, when we sit around and tell Ole and Lena jokes, which are exclusive. We might have to change our way of thinking and operating in the world to make Holden and our communities a little more welcoming and maybe more friendly to people of color. So we have to not be silent.
So it's almost time to close. Well, it is time to close. So my thing to you is that if you're not fighting against the things on this board, if you're not confronting that, then you're fighting the wrong battle. Mm-hmm. Being nice, being kind is wonderful. But unless you're getting your hands dirty with this stuff, you're fighting the wrong battle. All right, thank you.
Thank you.